Hey everyone, and welcome to the Hack My Homestead podcast. I'm pre-recording these episodes to be released the week of March 6th through 10th, 2023. And I am out of town. I'm with the family. We are in Park City, Utah, skiing. This is our last winter trip before my oldest daughter, who's building the schoolie, moves out. So we are going to just go to the well a little bit this week. I have about 4 years worth of expert counsel segments that I've done for the survival podcast. And what I'm going to do is each day I'm going to pick a theme, and that theme I'll pull in a couple different episodes that are in line with that theme. There'll be a little musical transition in between each, and you'll probably hear different recording styles just because, you know, I may be picking a battery show, for example, which is what today's theme is, one from 2020, one from 2021, and one from 2022. So you've got three different themes, or three different podcasts of the battery theme today. One of those is talking about the future of lithium iron phosphate. I recorded this last year. I think it's still relevant. Then another one where I'm talking about iron air batteries, and another one where I'm just generally going through a battery backup system. Now, in each of these segments, I'm referring to myself as Hack My Solar. For those of you that have been following me for a while, that was the original branding. We are definitely now Hack My Homestead, but in these older episodes, you're going to hear me refer to myself as Hack My Solar. So just to avoid any confusion, I wanted to mention that up front here. You can still find us at hackmyhomestead.com and my email, Sean, S-H-A-W-N, at hackmyhomestead.com. So enjoy the week, and I will be back with relatively live content on March 13th. Hey guys, this is Sean Mills with Hack My Solar, and I got a little bit of an update on battery technology for you today. So I've been getting a lot of questions from people about how Tesla and Ford switching to lithium iron phosphate batteries for shorter range vehicles might impact the availability of home scale battery storage, particularly since I've been telling people for about the past year, if you can afford it on the front end, lithium iron phosphate's the way to go. Well, what is happening is that China has gotten really good at manufacturing lithium iron phosphate cells, and the cost of those are down about 97% per kilowatt hour of storage since they were first introduced about 30 years ago. One other thing is that the patent on these batteries actually runs out next year. So right now, legally, they're only allowed to be made in China. After next year, they can be made anywhere. The issue that we have with electronic vehicles is that with all these competitors trying to get cars and trucks to the market to either create a sort of brand loyalty or to cash in on their existing brand loyalty, see the F-150 Lightning, they are running into supply chain issues with batteries specifically. There are gigafactories popping up all over the world to meet the new demand, but those factories have not sourced all of their supply chain partners. And the pandemic has both accelerated the electronic vehicle timeline as well as impacted the supply chains from the mines out. Currently, your electric vehicles are running on lithium nickel cobalt technologies, which are more energy dense, but they have other problems. Cobalt is a problem in that most of the world's reserves are in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. Now, I found that countries with Democratic Republic of in their name are typically not. North Korea, Congo, and Laos being some examples. There are lots of accusations of inhumane treatment of minors and exploitation of child workers. Cobalt is actually referred to by some as the blood diamond of batteries. Now, Tesla, as the EV leader, has already identified these issues, and they stated last year that they would be moving away from cobalt in their batteries. This, of course, created a greater demand for nickel. So Elon Musk has been asking mining companies to create more nickel. The United States Department of Energy actually identified the need earlier this year to have a national strategy for reshoring lithium ion battery production. A switch to the lithium iron phosphate batteries away from the lithium nickel cobalt eliminates the cobalt and the nickel in favor of iron, which is obviously easy to get in the United States, and phosphoric acid, which we produce a ton of here. These are both items that are easy to get. The supply chains already exist. There's nothing new that has to be done. So at the end of the day, lithium is really the only component that they need to be able to source. Lithium definitely is not as widely available in the U.S. as it is in China and Australia. But, you know, the more demand there is, the more that's going to be found. It's currently estimated that the U.S. has about 8 million tons of lithium resources, although only about 10% of that is considered to be economically extractable using current technology and prices. Well, what happens with these, metals is the same thing that happens with oil. When it is more expensive, there are more economically viable technologies. And as those technologies get better, it drives the price back down because the cost of production goes down. So you're going to see the same thing with lithium as you've seen over the past 100 years with oil production. So with all that being said, I think that at least for the next few years, you're going to continue to see the price of these batteries come down. Obviously, there's some supply chain issues that we've been dealing with this year, specifically for lithium iron phosphate batteries that are meant for off-grid or backup systems in the home. Now, once these gigafactories get up and running, and then potentially retool to make lithium iron phosphate batteries domestically. Again, they're all set up for the nickel cobalt technology right now. At that point, you might start to see some protectionist tariffs that will cause the prices to go up, or you could see tax incentives and grants provided to these companies to actually reduce the cost to the consumer. A lot of that depends on which party is in the White House. If you've got a Republican there, they're probably going to go to the side of tariffs, which is essentially is just an additional tax for you and I. And if you have a Democrat in the White House and controlling the Congress, you'll probably see tax incentives and grants, which are kind of the same thing. It's just subsidized over a much larger portion of the population. So the end user doesn't actually end up paying the full cost of those items. So I could see it going either way, but I think at least for the next couple of years, you're going to continue to see the price of these batteries come down. I do still think that whatever version of the Build Back Better plan gets passed is going to have that 30% tax incentive for both solar thermal, and wind installations. It's at 26% now and next year, and I believe the year after that, based on current law. So, you know, that extra 4% isn't a reason to run out and either get stuff right away or to, you know, put aside a project that you're already ready to move forward with. As any of these, thought processes or items change, as they continue to develop and as some of this technology begins to change, I will continue to follow it and I will share my thoughts with the community. Well, thanks everyone. Have a happy holiday season and we'll talk to you later. Hey guys, it's Sean Mills with Hack My Solar, and I've got a question from Dylan about the iron air battery. So Dylan says, Sean, Form Energy, a company in Massachusetts, claims to have developed an iron air battery with commercial costs as low as $20 per kilowatt hour. If that really comes to market, that would knock the socks off of current battery prices. The purported benefit of the tech, besides price, is a very long discharge cycle, 100 hours at rated discharge. The basics are that the battery uses a redox or reduction oxidation cycle, letting a bunch of small iron pellets rust with oxygen exposure and then reversing that process. I assume based on some reading and a couple links that the oxidation is the discharge cycle and the battery recharges with whatever generation input via some kind of electrolysis to reduce the rust back to iron. They have backing from a steel producer, which makes sense, as well as Bill Gates. I'm curious to hear Sean's thoughts. Dylan. Hey, Dylan, thanks for sending the question in. I have looked at this technology in the past.
As Inform Energy has been getting some good publicity recently because they just signed a deal to put one of these systems in Minnesota for Green River Energy. The system's supposed to come online in 2023. And at that point, I think we'll find out pretty quickly whether or not it can do what it says it can do. It is a very interesting technology in that it uses a much more widely available material to create a battery source with a longer discharge cycle, and looks like it can be built pretty much anywhere. That's helpful because it would allow a utility operator to buy energy as much as a week in advance of incoming bad weather at cheaper rates than energy will be produced during the bad weather. You'd have an opportunity, for example, to buy wind generation from Illinois at night when demand is low, and then put that energy back on the grid in the afternoon, people get home from work, over the course of several days to fill any gaps that you might end up with between your base load and peak at a much cheaper cost than ramping up any other type of production. Now, they don't tell us what's included in that $20 for kilowatt hour. If that's just the battery, and I need to build a climate-controlled storage facility with a massive electrical infrastructure in Minnesota dedicated to the facility that costs 20 times what the batteries cost, then, well, we're not as attractive. You know, that being said, according to a U.S. Department of Energy report from last year, the projected cost of other storage technologies from 2020 to 2030 are, your best one is compressed air storage. Compressed air storage, which is estimated to be the lowest cost, and it's at $119 per kilowatt hour, so five times higher, and it's highly dependent on being near a naturally occurring cavern that reduces the overall project costs. Pump storage hydro, so that's where we take the water, we use electricity to pump water into a holding tank that's then at a later date or time run through a hydro dam type project like we have in Tennessee on Raccoon Mountain, has a cost of about $262 per kilowatt hour. On the battery side, 100 megawatt 10 hour battery system lithium iron phosphate is about $356 per kilowatt hour. Lead acid is right there at about $356 per kilowatt hour. Lithium iron nickel manganese cobalt is at $366 per kilowatt hour, and a vanadium redox flow battery is at $399 per hour. So everything's in the, all the battery systems are in the $300 to $400 per kilowatt hour. And the other thing about all of these systems is that, you know, they have different upfront capital costs. The cost change if you're looking at a 4 hour or a 10 hour or a 100 hour or a 1,000 hour drawdown. You know, the depth of discharge you can get for the different types of battery technologies, the number of cycles, your round trip efficiency, changes based on the size of the installation. You know, so learning rates, if I am installing a 10 megawatt system versus a 100 megawatt system, well, I'm going to learn things that's going to increase my productivity, let's say around 20 megawatts. Well, on a 10 megawatt system, that learning does not ever get applied to the system, whereas for a 100 megawatt system, now 3/4 of the project get done at a more productive rate. So lots of different things, and this is why I'm really excited about the R&D that I think we're going to see over the next, 4 to 8 years, I guess, depending on the political climate, on specifically storage, because there are a lot of different interesting technologies out there. We just need to start using them and seeing which ones work and changing up the ones that don't. I was involved in a project years ago in Mississippi for a company called Keyore that was going to take biomass and turn it into basically, essentially barrels of oil to be refined into fuel and gasoline, or jet fuel and gasoline. And it was a great idea, and it was really interesting, and the technology worked. It just wasn't ever at the point to where it could be cost competitive. I was really excited about that job when I was out there insulating pipe. And then 5 years later, the company's in bankruptcy because they lied to the investors and they never could do what they said they were going to do. So the point is we need to get these technologies rolled out, at least at small scale so that we can pressure test them and see what actually works. I continue to think that behind the meter storage that's in the house but owned and operated by the local power company is probably the biggest game changer that we can employ right now. But this type of utility scale storage would have a significant impact. And, you know, let's get serious. It keeps the power in the hands of the generation and distribution companies, which have a lot more lobbying power than the individual consumers. You know, that being said, I'm very excited about this and a lot of the other technologies that are kind of in the same vein. Talked about a flywheel technology, you know, several months back, again, using more readily available components. And, you know, if it works the way that they say it does and the costs are what they say it's going to be, yeah, it's absolutely going to be a game changer, because solar and wind are already the cheapest levelized cost of energy types of production. So you put those together with a really, really cheap storage capability, and now all of a sudden you have the ability to run, you know, in my opinion, a nuclear-only base load with small pockets of natural gas, and then have renewables for everything else. So interesting times, and definitely interesting to hear about these new technologies. Well, guys, get these questions into me. I will continue to get them answered and get them back to Jack. Hey guys, this is Sean Mills with Akamai Solar, and today I've got an expert counsel question from Matt. Matt says, is cost the only reason more people don't use battery banks in grid-tied situations? Details, I have been reading about hot water storage tanks. This hot water quote-unquote battery can accept heat from many different types of sources and then provide hot water for various uses. Why don't more people use this type of setup for electricity? I would think that a battery bank, even in a grid-tied situation, would be really nice. If the power goes out, there's no need to switch over. I think a charge controller should make it easy to stop backfeeding onto the grid, and it would be relatively easy to add in other sources of electricity such as a generator, solar, wind, micro hydro, and whatever makes the most sense for the location and time of year. I'm sure the cost is high, but it seems like the benefits would be great without having the interruptions you get with switching over to a generator or another source. Thanks. Hey Matt, it's a great question, and you know, it comes down to a cost-benefit analysis. Most people are going to prep for the things that they perceive as having the biggest impact on them, and they will make trade-offs from a financial standpoint. So here's a thought experiment. Let's say I wanted to add enough battery backup to my home to be able to run my Energy Star rated chest deep freezer and refrigerator for 2 days in the event of a storm-related power outage. Those are the only two things I want to run, and I'm only looking at 48 hours until the power is back on. So a regular fridge is going to run about 1,300 watts per day, and a small chest freezer is going to be about the same. Now, you know, I'm not talking about a big, like 25-foot, you know, cubic foot freezer, which is going to run closer to 3,000 watts per day. Just a regular small one, you know, that I use to put meat in when I can buy it on sale. So let's use the 1,300 watts each figure, meaning that we need a battery bank to cover 2,600 watts per day of usage. That's 2.6 kilowatt hours. And the average cost of a kilowatt hour in the U.S. is about 10.5 cents, meaning the cost of operating these two appliances on a regular day when the grid is up is less than 30 cents or 60 cents for the 2 day period we're talking about. Now, I'm designing this battery bank to cover 2 days. I'm going to use flooded lead acid batteries and a 3,000 watt inverter with a regular plug-in charge controller. I want to maintain my batteries at or above 50% depth of discharge, which means at the end of the second day, right before my power comes back on, I don't want to have used more than half the available electricity. And I'm going to assume the duty cycle of the fridge is about 20% more due to the house not being climate controlled, since the power is out and my inverter is going to be about 95% efficient converting from DC over to AC. So putting those variables together means I need a battery bank with a 20-hour rating of about 6,568 watt-hours. But wait, can I use the 20-hour rating when I'm using this for the compressors that are being used for these two appliances? Probably not. Probably going to draw faster than that 20-hour rating. Realistically, I should probably look at the 10-hour rating. And again, this is because lead-acid batteries actually reduce their capacity the faster I draw the electricity out. So let's pick my favorite flooded lead acid battery, the Trojan T105 golf cart battery. This battery has a 10-hour rating of 207 amp hours at 6 volts, meaning each battery has 1,242 watt hours. If I divide 1,242 into 6568, I get 5.29 batteries. I need an even number because I'm going to design this for 12 volts. So I'm going to round up to 6 batteries at $150 each. Puts my battery bank right at $900. I'm going to add about $10 per battery for cables and connectors, $400 for my inverter, and about $150 for a charge controller. That brings the total cost of the system to $1,510. $1,510 to run something that costs 60 cents when the grid is up. Now, I might be able to wait for sales and use some cheaper components. Maybe I can shave $300 or $400 off this system, but best case scenario, we're talking about $1,100, right? Now, for that same $1,100, I can wait for a sale on a 4,500 watt inverter generator for about $800, buy two heavy duty 50 foot extension cords at $75 each, 4 or 5 gallon gas cans at $20 each, and then fill them up at $3.50 per gallon. So during this 2-day outage, I'll need to run this generator for about 30 minutes every 4 hours, and I'm gonna use less than 4 gallons of gas. And I can utilize a lot of other appliances at the same time. Well, the difference is with the battery bank, all I need to do is run my extension cords from the inverter to my components and wait for the power to come back on. However, once I get to day two, I need to do something to those batteries to get them charged back up, which means I'm probably cranking up a generator, right? Now, I could pair this with about 800 watts of solar and a solar charge controller, but obviously that's adding some more cost, and I can go for quite some time with 800 watts, assuming I have good unshaded area and a reliable solar aspect. The reality is in most parts of the United States, I can get on average four sun hours per day. So if I'm generating 800 watts times 4 hours, that's 3,200 watts. Derate that a little bit for efficiency losses, but I'm still hitting that 2,600 watts per day, charging those batteries back up, and then using them in the evening when the sun's not up. So that's where stacking those technologies really begins to make the cost benefit analysis change. To sum up, batteries can absolutely provide another layer of self-sufficiency. But as a backup power source, they do have their limitations. And for now, they're pretty expensive compared to the alternative. This is why a lot of people that come to me and think they want me to design a solar installation for them or behind the meter storage, and I kind of do the work and do the math and say, guys, I think you're probably better off with a generator and some stored gas. There are places where you can stack these, like I said, stack these technologies together where it really starts to make sense. But again, going back to the cost thing, are we willing to pay the money up front to be able to have that built-in self-sufficiency? As these components come down in cost, that cost-benefit analysis is going to change. Right now, flooded lead acid or lithium iron phosphate batteries is still kind of the way to go. They're still pretty expensive. And every time you take a little bit of electricity off the grid and put it in there, or take electricity from a solar panel and put it in there, you lose a little bit through efficiency losses. Like I said, sum up, batteries are a great idea. They definitely add that extra layer, but they need to be done the right way so that you don't have to replace them every other year. You got to be ready to spend that money. All right, guys, we'll keep the questions coming in, and I'll keep them getting them answered.